Throughout 2014, as the crunch continued and the development of The Witcher 3 grew more intense, the game kept evolving. The quest team overhauled large swaths of the story after realizing that not enough of their quests involved the ongoing war between the Nilfgaardian Empire and the Kingdom of Redania, which served as a backdrop to the game. The engineers rebuilt the streaming system, spending months trying to make objects load seamlessly in the background, so the player would see no loading screens while riding his or her horse from area to area. CD Projekt Red's programmers were also constantly trying to improve the game's tools. "There were times where the engine would crash 20 to 30 times a day," said Jakub Szamałek. "And actually that wasn't that bad, because we expected it to crash, so we'd save every 5 minutes." Every day, it seemed like something new in The Witcher 3 had changed. The artists decided to connect Novigrad and Velen, fusing them into a single big map rather than leaving them as two separate locations. The designers tweaked and modified it and iterated on just about everything. "We used to read the forums and check what people are asking for, and we'd actually add elements in the game based on people's feedback," said the lead quest designer, Matthijs Tomaszkiewicz. "For example, there was this footage of Novigrad at some point. You could see the city in the distance. And there were some hardcore fans in the forums that were discussing the city. In the books, it said that the city has very solid big walls, and in the trailer, it didn't. So we said, yeah, we probably should do that. And we did build it." Novigrad, a gigantic detailed city with narrow streets and red brick roofs, bore an uncanny resemblance to Warsaw's medieval old town. Both cities were intricate, cobbled, and full of life. Like Novigrad, Old Town was entirely fake, having been reconstructed brick by brick after it was destroyed by the German Luftwaffe in World War II. Unlike Novigrad, you could walk through Warsaw's Old Town without seeing beggars glitch out and start floating. Toward the end of 2014, as the developers of The Witcher 3 finally started to see the finish line, CD Projekt Red delayed the game another 12 weeks, from February to May 2015. The extra time would allow them to fix bugs, and the business department thought if they released in May, there would be fewer big releases next to The Witcher 3. "It was the perfect spot for us," said Konrad Tomaszkiewicz. "Actually, I think we were lucky. If we had released the game at the first date, we'd be competing with Dragon Age Inquisition, released in November 2014, and other games. In May, people had finished all the games from last year, and they were ready for a new big game." Another compelling reason to delay, CD Projekt Red staffers said, was so they wouldn't turn out like Assassin's Creed Unity, a game that had launched a couple of months earlier and was widely derided for its graphics glitches, including one particularly horrifying bug that made an NPC's face explode. Naturally, that face turned into an internet meme. During these final months, some departments had to crunch more than others. The writers had already been through their brutal deadlines, and toward the end of the project, they could relax a little bit. In those final months, their job was to write all the letters, notes, and other various bits of text that you'd see in the game. CD Projekt Red understands the position of writer very literally, because a writer is someone who writes, said Jakub Szamałek. "We're making sure that geese have goose displayed over their heads, and a piece of cheese is called a piece of cheese. And a legendary griffin trousers diagram is called exactly that." The writers went through the entire string database to ensure all the names made sense. "We had times where a cat was called deer, and the deer was called cheese and whatnot," Szamałek said. "After years of writing dialogue, that was actually very relaxing. We sat there and did things, and nobody bothered us." For other departments, however, the last few months were more brutal. Developers on the very end of the pipeline, like the audio team and the visual effects team, spent long nights at the office trying to finish up their work. The quality assurance testers had a particularly rough time. On a game as massive as The Witcher 3, with so many areas, quests, and characters, it would be physically impossible to find every game-breaking bug and glitch, but the testers still had to try. You start realizing not just sheer size of the game, but the sheer amount of possibilities on how you can do things, said Jose Teixeira. "The game crashes not if you go into a house, but if you talk to this person and if you get on a horse and then you go into a house." The testers started coming up with these sort of what-the-fuck situations. The Witcher 3 ended up shipping with lots of bugs, as every video game does, but the extra 3 months helped them avoid an Assassin's Creed Unity-like catastrophe. As the release date drew closer, the whole team started bracing for impact. Ever since the Game Informer cover, hype for The Witcher 3 had been building steadily, but who knew what the world would think? The developers thought the game might be good, and they were particularly proud of the story and writing, but neither of their previous Witcher games had drawn much of an audience outside hardcore PC gamers. Would The Witcher 3 really be able to compete with the likes of Skyrim and Dragon Age Inquisition? They were hoping to expand their audience and sell a few million copies, but what if they were being too optimistic? What if the game wasn't big enough? What if nobody cared about this RPG from Eastern Europe? Then the praise started coming in. On May 12, 2015, when The Witcher 3's reviews started going live on the internet, the hype reached a fever pitch. Wrote a reviewer for the website GameSpot, "Make no mistake, this is one of the best role-playing games ever crafted, a titan among giants and the standard setter for all such games going forward." Other reviews were equally adoring, and for the employees of CD Projekt Red, the next few days were surreal. Critics hadn't paid nearly this much attention to previous Witcher games, let alone lavished them with so many compliments. It was such a weird feeling because, looking back, you'd think people would be high-fiving each other like, "Wow, we made it," said Jose Teixeira. But we started reading these reviews and were just looking at each other going, "Holy shit, what do we do with this information?" Nobody worked that day, needless to say. Everybody was just on Google going, "Witcher 3 reviews," and refreshing. Suddenly, this became the best year in our careers. On May 19th, 2015, CD Projekt Red released The Witcher 3. Somehow, the game was even more massive than any of them had anticipated. Perhaps to overcompensate for that persistent fear that they wouldn't have enough content, they'd wound up making too much. Their goal had been a maximum gameplay time of 100 hours. But between quests, points of interest, and areas to explore, The Witcher 3's final count was closer to 200 hours. It could stretch out even longer if you played slowly. One could certainly argue about the merits of a game that long, and in retrospect, some at CD Projekt Red felt like they maybe should have chopped 10 or 20% of the game. But what was remarkable about The Witcher 3 was that very few of the quests felt like padding. Matthijs Tomaszkiewicz's edict to avoid FedEx quests had been successful. Every quest in The Witcher 3 had some sort of complication or twist, as Tomaszkiewicz had requested, which was a design tenet that BioWare's developers would later tell me they were hoping to use in their own games after Dragon Age Inquisition. CD Projekt Red, which had first found success when Marcin Iwiński got the rights to distribute BioWare's Baldur's Gate, had now made something that BioWare wanted to emulate. Who now could argue that European RPGs weren't as good? Throughout the sleek wooden halls of CD Projekt Red's sprawling office on the east side of Warsaw, a series of posters displayed the long-running game studio's catchy, if slightly awkward, slogan. "We are rebels," the posters said. "We are CD Projekt Red." It was fair to wonder, I thought, while strolling through a maze of desks and computers during the fall of 2016, just how that slogan meshed with reality. These days, CD Projekt Red was a publicly traded company with nearly 500 employees and offices in two cities. As I walked by one glass conference room full of people, my tour guide said it was an orientation for new staff. CD Projekt Red was hiring so many people, he added, that they had to start doing these orientations every week. After the company's astounding recent success, experienced game developers were emigrating from all over the world just to work here. The word rebels implied counterculture. It conjured the image of developers going against the grain, working together to make games that nobody else would think to make. CD Projekt Red, on the other hand, was now the largest game company in Poland and one of the most prestigious in the world. As of August 2016, the studio was worth over $1 billion. How exactly were they rebels? I think if you would have asked me this question a few years ago, I'd say probably at this size we wouldn't have the spirit, but we still do, said Marcin Iwiński. They made a big show of giving out free downloadable content for The Witcher 3. They spoke out often against digital rights management, DRM, a catch-all term for the anti-piracy technology that restricts how games are used, sold, and modified. CD Projekt Red's digital store, GOG, doesn't use DRM. Iwiński liked to say they believed in the carrot, not the stick. Rather than try to make their games impervious to pirates, they wanted to convince potential pirates that a CD Projekt Red game was worth the money, as they had all those years ago during the era of Poland's computer markets. "If you don't have the money to actually buy games, you have two options," said Rafał Jaki, a business development manager. "You won't play games, or you will pirate them. But then if you turn 20 and you start earning money, maybe you start buying games and you turn yourself into a consumer. But if you feel that all the industry is fucking you over, why would you do that? Why would you convert when you have the money and resources to actually buy something, when you feel that there's a DLC package with costumes for $25, and if you buy it at GameStop, you'll get the blue ribbon, but if you buy it somewhere else, you get the red one?" Fans tend to hate retail-exclusive downloadable content, a practice used by publishers like Square Enix and Ubisoft that spreads pre-order bonuses across different stores. Buying Final Fantasy XV at Amazon, for example, would get you a set of special weapons. Pre-ordering it at GameStop would get you a bonus minigame. Why would you do that? Even during development of The Witcher 3, the team at CD Projekt Red thought of themselves as rebels, not just because they were competing against so many bigger, more experienced companies, but because they made decisions that they didn't think other people would make. "It means that we are breaking all the rules in game design to achieve some particular goals," said Konrad Tomaszkiewicz. "To achieve those goals, from the pre-alpha of the game, I'm sitting in the room and I'm playing all the quests all the time. Actually, I played all the quests in The Witcher 3 around 20 times to check if everything is correct, if the dialogue in this quest is consistent with the previous quest and the next quest, if we don't have any gaps there. Because immersion is really crucial in our games, and if you will find the gaps or things we don't fit in the game, you will lose this immersion." As I sat in CD Projekt Red's cafeteria poking at a plate of vegetarian lasagna, I wondered if The Witcher 3 would have been possible anywhere else. The landscape outside Warsaw looked like a scene straight out of The Witcher 3, with its lush forests and frigid rivers. Poland's cost of living was low compared with that in North America and other European countries, which meant that CD Projekt Red could get away with paying its staff relatively low salaries. That was changing, Iwinski told me, as they attracted more expats. The game was also inspired heavily by Polish fairy tales, not to mention the ugly history of racism, warfare, and genocide surrounding Warsaw, all of which had crept into The Witcher 3. More than that, though, it was the people who worked there who made The Witcher 3 possible. In 2016, CD Projekt Red had a somewhat culturally diverse staff, with enough non-Polish natives that the studio had officially switched to English a while back, so they could all understand one another. But so many of them seemed to have chips on their tattooed Slavic shoulders. So many of them had grown up pirating games at the computer markets, where they'd score bootleg copies of games like Stonekeep and fantasize about one day making their own RPGs. "I think that in communism, many people's creativity was limited," said Konrad Tomaszkiewicz. "But after we were democrats, when everyone could do what they wanted to do, they started to fulfill the dreams they got in their heads." Even after the success of The Witcher 3, the developers at CD Projekt Red sounded motivated to keep proving that they were good enough to take the stage at shows like E3. Maybe that was what it meant to be rebels. Chapter 10. Star Wars 1313. Few video games have seemed as much of a sure thing as Star Wars 1313. It was the perfect mixture. Uncharted-style cinematic gameplay, in which the player would blast enemies and careen off flaming starships, combined with the rich lore of Star Wars, a series with more fans than just about anything on the planet. When the iconic game studio LucasArts showed its flashy Star Wars 1313 demo at E3 2012, people were stoked. Finally, after years of missed potential both on consoles and in theaters, Star Wars had returned to form. On the morning of June 5th, 2012, the first day of E3, a handful of Star Wars 1313 leads set up shop in a small, dimly lit meeting room on the second floor of the Los Angeles Convention Center. They blew up their concept art on big posters and decorated the walls to make it seem like visitors were descending into the hives of Coruscant. Although they weren't on the main floor of E3, LucasArts wanted to make a splash nonetheless. The past few years had been awful for their studio, and they wanted to prove that they could make great games again. For 3 days, Star Wars 1313's creative director, Dominique Robillard, and producer, Peter Nicolai, played through the demo, showing it to a new group of press and visitors every half hour. The demo opened with two nameless bounty hunters walking through a rusty ship, exchanging quips about the dangerous cargo they were about to take underground. As the two partners bantered, a group of pirates led by a malicious droid latched onto their ship, sending in a flood of several dozen baddies to invade the cargo hold. From there, we saw Star Wars 1313's combat in action as the player, controlling one of the bounty hunters, ducked behind a box and started shooting. After taking out a few enemies, first with blasters, then with an impressive half-Nelson that wouldn't have been out of place in a Jet Li movie, the protagonist and his partner made it to the back of their ship just in time to watch the pirates steal their cargo. Following some theatrics, and a delightfully vicious moment in which the player's partner stuffed an enemy inside a missile pod, then sent him off with a bang, both bounty hunters leaped onto the pirate ship to get back their mark. The player character, landing on one flaming hull, climbed across the crashing ships to keep up with his partner. And as he leaped across the wreckage, the demo cut to black. It was one of the sharpest-looking demonstrations at E3 that year, said Adam Rosenberg, a journalist and friend of mine who got a backstage look at the game. LucasArts tailor-made that clip to press the buttons of video game-loving Star Wars geeks everywhere, and it worked. Other reporters were just as thrilled, and fans started praising Star Wars 1313 as one of the best demos they'd ever seen. With Star Wars 1313, LucasArts' stint of mediocrity finally seemed to be coming to an end. What could possibly go wrong? When the modern video game industry first started emerging in the early 1980s, film moguls stared over with a mixture of envy and consternation. How were these game makers, with their immature stories and wildly inconsistent product cycles, making millions of dollars off this strange interactive new media? And how could Hollywood get a piece of this? Some movie studios licensed out their franchises or worked with game publishers to crank out cheap tie-in games like the infamous E.T., best known for helping crash the video game industry. Released by Atari in 1982, E.T. is widely considered one of the worst games of all time. Its disastrous launch helped trigger the video game crash of 1983 and eventually led Atari to bury a truckload of unsold cartridges in the New Mexico desert. 30 years later, in April 2014, excavators unearthed the cartridges. The game was still terrible. Others decided not to bother. In future years, respected directors like Guillermo del Toro and Steven Spielberg would dabble in game development, but in the 1980s, only one filmmaking giant had the foresight to build an entire company around video games. George Lucas. In 1982, 5 years after the release of his smash hit film Star Wars, Lucas saw the potential of video games and decided to get involved. He spun up a subsidiary of his production company, Lucasfilm, calling the new studio Lucasfilm Games, and hired a squad of talented young designers like Ron Gilbert, Dave Grossman, and Tim Schafer. In the coming years, Lucasfilm Games found success not with movie tie-ins, but with completely original point-and-click adventure games like Maniac Mansion and The Secret of Monkey Island. A reorganization in 1990 turned Lucasfilm Games into LucasArts. And over the coming years, their iconic logo, a gold man holding up a shining arc, would adorn the boxes of beloved games like Grim Fandango, Star Wars TIE Fighter, Day of the Tentacle, Star Wars Jedi Knight, and many more. Throughout the 1990s, the name LucasArts was a badge of quality. A few years into the 21st century, something changed. As George Lucas and his company doubled down on the much-derided Star Wars prequel films, LucasArts became entrenched in office politics and unstable leadership. The studio became best known for publishing other developers' games, like Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, BioWare, and Star Wars Battlefront Pandemic, rather than making its own. Over 10 years, LucasArts went through 4 different presidents. Simon Jeffrey in 2000, Jim Ward in 2004, Daryl Rodriguez in 2008, and Paul Meegan in 2010. Each time a new president took over, there would be a staff-wide reorganization, which always meant 2 things, layoffs and cancellations. After one particularly massive layoff in 2004, LucasArts essentially shut down and then spun back up again, which was surreal for those who remained. One former employee recalled roller skating around half of the building, which he had all to himself. As one former employee would later tell me, the Bay Area is filled with people who have had their hearts broken by Lucasfilm or LucasArts. That sad legacy of multiple presidents, multiple layoffs. There's a lot of people out there who've been treated badly by the company. Despite this, there were many at LucasArts who believed they could restore the studio to its former glory. LucasArts paid well and had no trouble attracting talented developers who had grown up on Star Wars and wanted to make games in that universe. In early 2009, under President Daryl Rodriguez, LucasArts began developing a Star Wars project with the codename Underworld. They envisioned it as a video game tie-in to the live-action TV series of the same name, which George Lucas had been developing for years. The Underworld show was meant to be an HBO-style take on Star Wars, set on the planet Coruscant, which was sort of like a cross between New York City and Gamora. The show would take place between the 2 Star Wars film trilogies, and there would be no CGI puppets or hammy child actors this time around. Instead, Underworld would feature crime, violence, and brutal conflicts between mafia families. Both the game and TV show were meant for adult Star Wars fans. In meetings throughout 2009, a small group of LucasArts developers quietly began conceptualizing Star Wars Underworld, batting around ideas for what the game might look like. For some time, they saw it as a role-playing game. Then they expanded their focus, knowing that George Lucas was fascinated by Grand Theft Auto, GTA. His kids were into the games. How cool would it be, the developers thought, if they could make a GTA-style open-world game within the scummy underworld of Coruscant? You, perhaps playing as a bounty hunter or some other sort of criminal, could traipse around the world, going on missions as a contractor for different crime families as you worked your way up through the ranks. That idea fizzled fast. After a few weeks of research based on conversations with colleagues at GTA's developer Rockstar and Assassin's Creed's publisher Ubisoft, the Underworld team put together a proposal of how many people they'd need, hundreds, and how much money it'd cost, tens of millions, to make an open-world game of that nature. Lucasfilm's executives weren't interested. "Of course there was no appetite to make that kind of investment," said one person involved with the game. "That idea came and went literally within the span of 2 months." It was a running theme at LucasArts. To get anything done, the studio's management would need to go up the ladder to their bosses at Lucasfilm, who for the most part were old-school filmmakers with little interest in video games. Sometimes frustrated LucasArts managers would give elaborate presentations to Lucasfilm executives simply to explain to them how games were made. Those Lucasfilm executives also served as gatekeepers to George Lucas, often giving LucasArts developers guidelines for how to talk to the legendary auteur. One common directive, never say no. Lucas, who owned 100% of the company, was still interested in video games, but seemed, to those who worked closely with him, to feel let down by LucasArts' recent history. Couldn't they be doing so much better? By the end of 2009, the Underworld project had morphed into what the team snarkily referred to as Gears of Star Wars, a cooperative game focused on running, shooting, and taking cover, not unlike Epic Games' seminal Gears of War series. By this point, Underworld was much less of a secret. Over the next few months, the project expanded significantly, recruiting staff from elsewhere at LucasArts as they built prototypes and got online multiplayer functionality up and running. It was an interesting, albeit much more conservative, less adventurous version of Underworld by one account. In the summer of 2010, the wheel of LucasArts president spun yet again. Out went Daryl Rodriguez. In came a tough, ambitious new president named Paul Meegan. With this change of leadership came, as usual, big layoffs and project cancellations, including a massive technology shift. Meegan, who had previously worked at Epic Games, wanted LucasArts to switch from its own proprietary technology to Epic's popular Unreal Engine. Meegan also thought Underworld was too conservative. He had a big plan for the future of Star Wars video games, a plan that included the gradual revival of the beloved Battlefront shooter series, and he wanted to see LucasArts make a big splash. By then, Meegan would tell people, it was too late to salvage the studio's output on the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. But for next-generation consoles, which were expected within the next 2 years, LucasArts could do something consequential. "LucasArts is a company with tremendous potential," Meegan later said in an interview. "And yet, in recent years, LucasArts hasn't always done a good job of making games. We should be making games that define our medium, that are competitive with the best of our industry. But we're not. That has to change." Shortly after taking over, Meegan sat down with Dominique Robillard, the game's creative director, and the other LucasArts leads to talk about a new vision for Underworld. George Lucas's TV series was stuck in development hell, but Meegan and Robillard still loved the idea of a Star Wars game set in the criminal underworld of Coruscant. They also loved Naughty Dog's Uncharted series, which blended the feel of an action-adventure game with the spectacle of a blockbuster movie. Making Gears of Star Wars wasn't all that appealing, but Star Wars Uncharted? Working under Lucasfilm had its challenges, sure, but LucasArts benefited from sharing a campus with Industrial Light and Magic, ILM, the legendary visual effects house that had produced special effects and graphics for the original Star Wars. For years, Lucasfilm and LucasArts had wanted to find ways to blend film technology with video games. What better way than with an Uncharted-style Star Wars game? Out of these conversations came design documents and concept art, and by the end of 2010, LucasArts had come up with Star Wars 1313, named after the 1,313th level of Coruscant's underworld. The goal, as LucasArts designers described it, was to evoke the fantasy of being a bounty hunter. Using a wide array of skills and gadgets, the player would hunt down targets for unsavory criminal families. "Nobody had quite nailed that in Star Wars games," said one person who worked on 1313. "We wanted to do something, and this actually came from George, that didn't rely on the Force, or Jedi." Part of this process meant pointing the entire team in a single direction, a somewhat vague but crucial goal. When I started on the game, my goal was really to find out what everybody was thinking, said the lead designer Steve Chen, a veteran LucasArts employee who had moved to Star Wars 1313 in late 2010. Because I had seen it as an open-world game, I'd seen it as a buddy game, I'd seen it as more of a shooter. I'd seen it as many, many different things. It was all over the map. When Chen started, he spent a few weeks sitting down with everyone on the team and asking what stood out to them about Star Wars 1313. What did they care about most? What did they want the game to be? What I was trying to do was find the core and get rid of the stuff that didn't feel like it was important, Chen said. Here's an incredibly talented group of people with a lot of great ideas and a lot of skill, but not a lot of focus. One of Megan's next big moves was to hire a new studio manager, Fred Marcus, a grizzled developer who had been working in games since 1990. Marcus was a loyal acolyte of what he'd refer to as the Nintendo approach to game design. Keep fine-tuning your gameplay until it's perfect. Marcus joined the company and really made a huge change to the creative culture at LucasArts, a creative change much for the better, said Chen. He was really quite a force to be reckoned with in the studio, and he made big changes from a culture standpoint from day one. Marcus, who had spent years at Ubisoft helping shape franchises like Far Cry and Assassin's Creed, would preach about adding structure to the chaos of game development by identifying every worst-case scenario as early as possible. For example, if they were making a game in the subterranean levels of Coruscant, they'd need to think about verticality. The player, while hunting for bounties, would have to ascend and descend different levels of the city. But moving upward tended to be less fun than moving downward, and chasing a mark up a flight of stairs could feel sluggish. As a solution, maybe they'd add high-speed elevators. Maybe they'd use grappling hooks. Whatever the answer, Marcus wanted his team to solve the problem before they even entered production. Not long after starting at LucasArts, Marcus put the studio through what one former staffer described as a boot camp for controls, camera work, and basic gameplay rhythms. Marcus believed the best way to make a video game was to spend as much time as possible in pre-production, which meant lots of talking, prototyping, and answering questions both big and small. What exactly did it mean to live out the fantasy of being a Star Wars bounty hunter? How would the controls work? What kind of gadgets would you have? How would you traverse the underground of Coruscant? He was really kind of a great influence on our team and on the studio in general, said Steve Chen. Not necessarily the easiest person to deal with because he was tough, but his effects on the studio and on the project were, in my opinion, a huge positive. He was really forcing us to take a good hard look at what the core of the game was. Another of their principles was to avoid taking control away from the player. One of the things that Dom Robiliard, the creative director, felt strongly about was, whenever possible, you want the player to be doing something that was cool, not watching something that was cool, said Evan Skolnick, the lead narrative designer. For a while, pre-production proceeded nicely. The Star Wars 1313 team started scoping for a fall 2013 or early 2014 release, with the hope of the game becoming a launch title for the still unannounced PS4 and Xbox One. For months, they played with prototypes and worked on the new story, which would revolve around their audacious bounty hunter. The engineers grew more familiar with the Unreal Engine, working closely with ILM to sort out how to make Star Wars 1313 look as next-gen as possible. As Fred Marcus, Dominique Robiliard, and the rest of the team tried to sort out their vision for Star Wars 1313, George Lucas would sporadically check in and offer suggestions. As I was going back and forth with him on story and gameplay details, Robiliard said during a panel discussion at the DICE Summit in February 2017, he would allow us to use more of the locations that he had come up with and more of his characters. Occasionally, according to team members, he'd come in and say they could, and should, use new bits and pieces from the Star Wars Underworld show. At first, we were in the same universe, said one person on the team. Then it was location. Then it was rewrite the story and start using more of the characters from the TV show. In theory, the developers of Star Wars 1313 were thrilled about getting to use more of Lucas's canonical Star Wars universe, but in practice, it was incredibly frustrating. With every new character or setting, the team had to scrap and redesign large chunks of the game. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say we probably developed 30 hours worth of Focus Testable gray box content before we even started making the game that we ended up with, said a person who worked on the game. It wasn't that George Lucas was trying to be malicious. People who worked on the game say he loved how Star Wars 1313 was shaping up. But in Lucas's preferred craft, filmmaking, everything existed to serve the story. While in game development, at least on the type of game that Marcus and Robiliard wanted to make, everything existed to serve gameplay. One of the problems of working in a film company with somebody like George is that he's used to being able to change his mind and iterate on things purely on a visual level, said a person who worked on the game. He wasn't used to the idea that we were developing gameplay mechanics that go along with these concepts, levels, and scenarios. Star Wars 1313's leads theorized that as George Lucas saw more of the game, his trust in the developers grew, which made him feel more comfortable giving them more of his universe to play with. Besides, he could do whatever he wanted. It was his company. His name was in the title, and he owned all the stock. As LucasArts employees like to say, we serve at the pleasure of George Lucas. I've had the pleasure of presenting to George on different projects once or twice, maybe a handful of times in my years at LucasArts. And the first thing George will always say is, I'm not a gamer, said Steve Chen, who didn't work with George Lucas directly on 1313 but had on previous games. But he has really clear ideas about what story's like and what the experience should be like. If he made a request or made a suggestion about something in terms of story or character or gameplay, you feel like he's coming at it from his perspective, and you have to respect that as president of the company and chief creative force for the company. The ripple effects, I don't know if that was necessarily the top of his mind, like, oh, is this decision I'm making going to change what the team does? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I don't think that's the highest priority for him. That was for us to worry about. The most drastic of these changes arrived in the spring of 2012. Earlier that year, they decided to announce Star Wars 1313 at E3, and the entire team was crunching on the flashy demo that would showcase their two bounty hunters. After all these years of development, and the poor recent output from LucasArts, the 1313 team felt big pressure to make a splash. Years of public layoffs, rushed games, and canceled projects had cost LucasArts whatever prestigious reputation it had in the 1990s. We were at that point and not super sure what the public's or press's impression of a LucasArts game was, said Chen. I would say candidly it was probably spotty at best. So putting something out at that point had a lot of gravitas attached to it. 2 months before E3, George Lucas approached LucasArts leadership with a new mandate. Star Wars 1313 should star the bounty hunter Boba Fett. Lucas wanted to explore the backstory of the enigmatic mercenary, who had first appeared in The Empire Strikes Back and was revealed in the prequels to be a clone of Jango Fett, progenitor of the Republic's clone troopers. Instead of 1313's current hero, Lucas said, they should use a younger, pre-Empire version of Boba. To the Star Wars 1313 development team, this was like being told that they had to reroute an oil tanker. They'd already designed a protagonist, who had his own story, personality, and background. They'd cast the actor Wilson Bethel to play their hero, and the team had already recorded dialogue and captured many of Bethel's facial movements. Both Fred Marcus and Dominique Robillard pushed back, telling Lucas that changing the main character at this point would be a monumental undertaking. It would require the team to reboot everything, they explained. What if instead they added Boba as a non-playable character, integrating him into the story without changing the hero they'd spent years developing? Couldn't they find some other solution? The answer to those questions was no, and word soon came down from Lucasfilm's management that the decision was final. Star Wars 1313 was now a game about Boba Fett. We had a whole story planned out, said one person who worked on the game. We were in full pre-production at that point. Every level for that version of the game had been planned and written. At that point, we were on the fourth or fifth draft of the story. It was at the point where we were all super excited about it. Word also came down that LucasArts couldn't talk about Boba Fett at E3, which meant that for the next 2 months, the Star Wars 1313 staff had to build a demo around a character that they knew wouldn't be in the final game. On one hand, this made for a good opportunity to test out their new technological pipeline, which used ILM's film rendering techniques to create flashy smoke and fire effects, allowing for some of the most photorealistic spaceship crashes one could find in this galaxy. And they could also experiment with facial motion capture, one of their most impressive and most challenging pieces of tech. Human faces are the one thing that we as human beings are very tuned to know when something's right and something's wrong, said Steve Chen. Getting that right took a lot of work. A lot of work. In terms of skin tone and lighting and surface texture and expression itself. Any tiny little thing where the face doesn't quite move in the right way or the eyes don't look quite right will set your mind off. On the other hand, this E3 demo would take months of their lives, long days and late nights, all dedicated to characters and encounters that might never actually appear in their game. Robillard told the team they would try to salvage as much of the demo as possible, though they knew the story would be gone. Maybe it'd be worth the stress, though. The Star Wars 1313 team knew they needed to impress people, Even within LucasArts, there was a concern that the hammer might come down at any time, that the studio's parent company, Lucasfilm, would cancel the game, that they'd suffer more layoffs, that Paul Meighan might be another casualty of the cursed title, LucasArts President. To Fred Marcus, Dominique Robillard, and the rest of the team, simply announcing 13-13-83 wouldn't be enough. They had to be the best thing there. If you walked around downtown Los Angeles during early June 2012, you'd probably hear people talking about two games, Watch Dogs and Star Wars 13-13. Both looked incredible. Both were planned for next-gen consoles that hadn't been announced yet. Neither Sony nor Microsoft were pleased with Ubisoft and LucasArts for showing their hands so early. And both games had stolen the show. Days of showing Star Wars 13-13's impressive Bounty Hunter demo had resulted in exactly the type of buzz that LucasArts needed that summer. Critics wondered if, like many of the sizzling demos that game publishers brought to shows like E3, Star Wars 13-13 was all smoke and mirrors. Was this a target render, demonstrating the type of graphics that the development team wanted to achieve rather than what they could actually make? Or would the game really look like that? It was playable. I played it, and it was not the kind of thing where if you did one thing slightly incorrectly, the whole thing fell apart, said Evan Skolnick, the lead narrative designer. All those mechanics you see are things that were working in the game. After years of reboots and endless pre-production, the Star Wars 13-13 team had momentum. The press was excited, the public was hyped, and Star Wars 13-13 seemed real, even if nobody outside the studio knew that the main character was actually going to be Boba Fett. Some on the team still found it strange that Lucasfilm had barred the 13-13 team from talking about Boba at E3, but seeing Star Wars 13-13 win E3 awards and leap to the top of press outlets' most anticipated games lists was thrilling for them. Especially those who had been at LucasArts for the past decade and watched the revolving door of presidents in action. Finally, it felt like they'd reached stability. Once they'd flown back to San Francisco, the Star Wars 13-13 team gathered and started sketching plans for entering production. In the films, one of Boba Fett's most iconic accessories was his jetpack, which the development team knew they'd have to add to their game in some way. But they didn't know how to approach that. Would it be more of a jump pack, propelling the player forward large distances, or a hover pack, allowing you to hold down a button and gain altitude? Or something else entirely? Just a simple decision like that can completely change what sort of levels you're going to build, what sort of enemies you're going to design, what it looks like on screen, how it controls, said Steve Chen, who left the Star Wars 13-13 team after E3. Something as simple as that has huge ramifications. Either way, with Boba Fett in the starring role, the designers would have to reimagine all the encounters they'd planned. Enemies would need to be aware of the player's jetpack so they could take cover from attacks that came from above them, which, as one member of the 13-13 team told me, was a major pain in the ass. LucasArts still had momentum, though. In the weeks after E3, as part of a planned hiring ramp-up, the studio recruited a dozen veteran developers from across the industry. The 13-13 team was still relatively small, around 60 people, with hopes of expanding to 100 or even 150, but they had a great deal of experience. Usually on a team, there's a mixture of senior people, mid-level people, and juniors that would be learning the ropes and learning from the seniors who were mentoring them, said Evan Skolnick. This team, it seemed like everyone was just senior level. Everyone knew their stuff really well and were basically all-stars, so it was really amazing to be working with that caliber of talent across the board on that team. Around September 2012, two strange things happened. First, Lucasfilm told LucasArts not to announce the other game they'd been developing, a shooter called Star Wars First Assault that the studio had planned to reveal that month. Second was a studio-wide hiring freeze. Lucasfilm executives said it was temporary. LucasArts president Paul Meighan had just quit, and the polarizing Lucasfilm president Micheline Chow was on her way out. But either way, it put the brakes on the Star Wars 13-13 team's plans. They needed more staff to enter full production. To LucasArts, these moves made no sense. They were all feeling motivated after a spectacular E3 showing, and they had fans on their side, with video game news outlets everywhere publishing articles about how LucasArts might finally be back. It was, as one LucasArts employee said, a weird disconnect. Game development was so often about this sort of momentum, and LucasArts had struggled so much to get their projects revving over the past decade. Why wouldn't their parent company want to help them out? Why wouldn't they want to keep riding the 13-13 train while it was at full speed? The answer to all those questions was roughly $4 billion. On October 30th, 2012, in a shocking blockbuster move, Disney announced that it was purchasing Lucasfilm, and with that, LucasArts, for $4 billion. All the weird changes suddenly made sense. Lucasfilm wasn't going to make big announcements or hire dozens of new game developers when it knew Disney might have other plans in motion. And Disney's main interest was, as the company made clear when it revealed the deal, to produce more Star Wars movies. In the press release Disney sent out to announce its purchase, the word LucasArts appeared once. Video games did not appear. To say that LucasArts employees were stunned by this news would be like saying Alderaan was a little bit shaken up. For close to a decade, rumors had been floating that George Lucas might retire. He'd admitted to feeling traumatized by the fan backlash to his prequel films, but few people thought he'd follow through, even as he made his intentions clear. "I'm retiring," Lucas had told New York Times Magazine in January 2012. "I'm moving away from the business, from the company, from all this kind of stuff." He had made comments like that in the past, though, so to see the legendary director sell his company was surreal for everyone who worked for him. "We just didn't know quite what to expect," said Evan Skolnick. "We were hopeful that it would mean good things for us, but I think we were well aware that it might not mean good things." To video game reporters, Lucasfilm representatives said the acquisition wouldn't affect Star Wars 1313. "For the time being, all projects are business as usual," the company said in a statement, mirroring comments that Disney's CEO, Bob Iger, made internally to LucasArts staff. "Business as usual," he told them all in a meeting. But there was one giant glaring red flag. Immediately after news of the acquisition broke, Iger said on a conference call that the company would look to license Star Wars to other video game companies rather than publish its own games, and that Disney was likely to focus more on social and mobile than we are on console. It was a "wait, what?" moment for LucasArts staff. They had two games currently in development, and both were on consoles. If Disney was going to make games for a more casual audience, where did that leave LucasArts? Some Star Wars 1313 leads read the tea leaves and decided to call it quits, including Fred Marcus, who resigned shortly after the acquisition. And the hiring freeze continued, which meant not only that the Star Wars 1313 team couldn't expand, but that it couldn't replace the people who were leaving. LucasArts couldn't stop the bleeding. Dominique Robillard and those who were left on the Star Wars 1313 team continued to work. They were optimistic that they still had the right combination of pieces to make something great. A good video game hook, a talented core staff, and top-notch technology. Plus, they figured their Boba Fett game would fit nicely with Disney's announced plans to make a new trilogy of Star Wars films. Star Wars 1313 was set between the first two trilogies, so it wouldn't interfere with the newly planned episodes 7 through 9. In the weeks after the Disney purchase, Star Wars 1313's developers put together a demo that they could show to their new corporate overlords, which Disney assessed with some interest. "They were interested in learning everything about the company they had just purchased, so they wanted to know about every project," said Evan Skolnick. "They were looking at the company holistically, as you would of a company you had just purchased for several $1 billion. So I think that 1313 was, along with every other in-progress project and planned project at the company as a whole, subject to evaluation, investigation, questioning, and eventually a decision based on every one of those analyses." Disney stayed quiet, though, and as 2012 ended and the new year came around, LucasArts employees still didn't know where they stood. Several people left for new jobs, and others started sending out applications, knowing that the studio wasn't making any progress. It felt like they were in purgatory, or maybe frozen in carbonite, as everyone at LucasArts waited to hear what Disney was going to do. Some thought Bob Iger might axe Star Wars 1313 and First Assault in favor of a new slate of games, maybe tied to the movies. Others guessed that Disney would overhaul LucasArts, transforming it into a developer of casual and mobile games. All of them crossed their fingers that Disney would just let them keep doing what they were doing, and that it really would be, as Iger had promised, business as usual. The next red flag came in late January 2013, when Disney announced that it had shut down Junction Point, the Austin-based studio behind the artsy platformer Epic Mickey. "These changes are part of our ongoing effort to address the fast-evolving gaming platforms and marketplace and to align resources against our key priorities," Disney said in a statement. In non-corporate speak, what that meant was that Epic Mickey: The Power of Two, the sequel to Epic Mickey that Junction Point had released in November 2012, had bombed. Disney didn't offer sales numbers, but reports pegged the Power of Two's first month sales at around a quarter of what the first games had been, which was especially atrocious considering that the first Epic Mickey had been a Wii exclusive, while Epic Mickey the Power of Two was on several platforms. As Iger had hinted, console games just hadn't worked out very well for Disney, which was inauspicious for LucasArts. By February 2013, the whispers had grown louder. Both in and out of the studio, rumors flew that Disney was planning to shut down LucasArts. Employees would exchange knowing glances in the halls and sometimes even openly muse about the company's future. Still, there was a lingering sense at LucasArts that Star Wars 1313 was untouchable. Surely with all the fans talking about how exciting the game looked, Disney would have to finish making it. In the worst-case scenario, the developers thought, maybe Disney would sell 1313 to another big publisher. I think there may have been a feeling that because we had built up so much anticipation for the game, and we had just done so well at E3 in 2012, having won and been nominated for so many awards, and really got the press and the fanbase excited, that we felt it might be enough to save the project, said Evan Skolnick. That 1313 couldn't be canceled now, because there was so much anticipation. What became clear to LucasArts staff later, some said, was that Disney had given them a grace period. For several months, Disney allowed LucasArts to operate as if things were normal, while it sought deals with other publishers for the future of both the studio and Star Wars video games. Of all the interested parties, there was one publisher that showed the most excitement, Electronic Arts. Throughout the early months of 2013, EA negotiated extensively with Disney, talking about all sorts of possible options for the future of LucasArts. Rumors began to float around the studio that, hey, maybe LucasArts would be fine. Maybe EA wanted to buy them. All winter, LucasArts management would proclaim that things were going to be okay, even telling employees not to bother handing out their resumes at the annual Game Developers Conference in March. The biggest rumor, as conveyed by several LucasArts employees, was that EA had a deal in place to buy LucasArts and finish production on Star Wars 1313 and First Assault. But then, the rumor alleged, the new SimCity turned out to be a debacle, which led to EA and its CEO, John Riccitiello, mutually agreeing to part ways, which caused the LucasArts deal to fall apart. Riccitiello, however, told me that these negotiations weren't as close as LucasArts employees had believed. Virtually everything gets discussed on some deal with somebody, he said. Most of it is fantasy. Then, everything collapsed. On April 3, 2013, Disney shut down LucasArts, laying off nearly 150 employees and canceling all the studio's projects, including Star Wars 1313. It was the final act to a long period of turbulence at LucasArts, and the end of an era for one of the most treasured studios in gaming. To those who remained at the studio, this felt both shocking and inevitable. Some left the building to go drink at a nearby sports bar, called, oddly enough, Final Final, and bemoan what might have been. Others stayed back and ransacked the place, using flash drives to grab half-finished trailers and demos off the LucasArts servers before they all disappeared. A few former employees even stole console development kits. After all, the employees figured Disney didn't need them. But there was still one sliver of hope. During the final hours of LucasArts, a top EA executive, Frank Gibeau, set up one last-ditch meeting to try to save Star Wars 1313. Gibeau told LucasArts to put together a strike team for a salvage mission at EA's headquarters. Dominique Robillard gathered a small team of leads to meet at EA's sprawling campus in Redwood City, California. There they would give a pitch to Visceral, the EA-owned developer of Dead Space and Battlefield Hardline. If all went well, Gibeau said, Visceral would hire the core staff of Star Wars 1313 and continue working on the project there. Standing in front of a packed room of Visceral employees, Robillard and his leads gave a lengthy presentation on Star Wars 1313. They talked about the story, describing in detail how you'd fight your way through the seedy hive of Coruscant, unraveling a spice trade conspiracy and watching your closest friends stab you in the back. They showed all the cool mechanics they'd prototyped, like the flamethrower and wrist-based rocket launcher. They walked everyone through the hours of levels they'd built in Greybox, where there were detailed layouts of each stage, but no art. It was clear that A, there was plenty of work left to be done, and B, Star Wars 1313 had a lot of potential. Then, as one person who was in the room recalled, nobody said anything. All heads turned to Steve Papoutsis, Visceral's longtime studio manager and the man who would ultimately get to make the final call. For a few seconds, Papoutsis just sat there, looking at the desperate faces of the Star Wars 1313 team. Then he started to talk. He stood up in front of all the Lucas and Visceral people, said one person who was in the room. and just said, "Well, I don't know exactly what you've been told, but I can tell you that what you think is going to happen right now is not what's going to happen." Then, according to that person, Papoutsis said he had no interest in resuscitating Star Wars 1313. Instead, he and his studio would conduct interviews with all of 1313's key staff. If Isra liked them, he said, the studio would hire them for a brand new project. The Star Wars 1313 leads were shocked. They'd come to EA's campus in hopes of convincing Visceral to finish their game, not to get new jobs. Many of them had held on to the hope that even after everything they'd been through, they could still save Star Wars 1313. Even the most cynical of LucasArts staff, the ones who thought that Star Wars 1313's cinematic technology would never work properly in a video game, believed that the game had too much potential to fail. Some leads left immediately. Others stayed and took interviews for what would eventually become a brand new Star Wars action-adventure game directed by Amy Hennig, who joined Visceral in April 2014 after leaving Naughty Dog over Uncharted 4. Later, a dejected Dominique Robilliard sent out an email to the entire Star Wars 1313 team. It opened, "I had hoped that I could address you all face-to-face as usual, but it seems that we are already scattered to the winds, and the chances of a well-attended gong meeting are slim. It's probably for the best, as I'm not sure I could get through what I have to say to you all and keep it together. When I look back on the last couple of years making this game, I cannot believe what we achieved under the circumstances we had to deal with. It really is astonishing. Redirections, interference, unstable management and studio leadership. Sometimes I just can't believe you have stayed with me, and more importantly, still deliver such an incredibly high quality of work. I cannot tell you how proud I am of every single game maker on this team. I will be in your debt for the rest of my career." Robilliard went on to compliment the team's work on gameplay. The jetpack was the final piece of the puzzle, and visual technology. "All of the effort and consideration that went into our carefully and lovingly constructed look was so worth it." He praised the work they had done on the E3 demo. "I lost count of how many publications and interviews at E3 said that Star Wars 1313 was literally the best thing they had ever seen, and lamented the fact that LucasArts would never get to deliver on the game they'd promised. I have plenty more to say, and so much more gratitude to show you all, but right now it's too hard to articulate it," Robilliard wrote. "I genuinely care for everyone on this team, and hope desperately that we will work together again someday. Until then, I will dedicate all my time and energy over the coming months to making sure that anyone who is thinking of hiring a Star Wars 1313 team member knows that they will be making an amazing investment and the smartest decision of their career. You are the greatest team I have ever known, and I love you all." Video games get canceled all the time. For every shipped game under a developer's belt, there are dozens of abandoned concepts and prototypes that never see the light of day. But something about Star Wars 1313 has always felt unique, not just to fans, but also to those who worked on it. "From my point of view, the game was not canceled," said Steve Chen. "The studio was canceled. It's a very different thing." Years later, members of the Star Wars 1313 team still speak of their time on the game in revered tones. And many believe that the game might have been a huge success if it had been given an opportunity to succeed. "If the phone rang," said Evan Skolnick, "and it was them calling to say, 'Hey, we want you to come back and make a new 1313, I'd be asking what time they want me there." In one LucasArts meeting room, there was a big bulletin board, adorned with beautiful illustrations and hundreds of colored post-it notes. From left to right, these notes told the story of Star Wars 1313, laying out how Boba Fett would descend into the depths of Coruscant. There were 10 missions, given tentative yet evocative titles like Downfall and Scum and Villainy. The designers had plotted out every sequence in shorthand, lining up cards like Fight in Back of Casino and Chase Droid Through Subway Tunnels, alongside brief descriptions of the powers you'd get and the emotional beats you'd hit. If you read them in order, you could visualize exactly what Star Wars 1313 might have been. Eventually, that board would come down, but as LucasArts closed its doors and its staff said their final farewells to the once legendary game studio, it was a story frozen in time. A snapshot of a game that would never happen. Epilogue. 2 years later, you've done it. You've made a video game. Super Plumber Adventure is out on all the big platforms. PC, Xbox One, PlayStation 4, even Nintendo Switch. And you can finally brag to all your friends that you turned your dream into a reality. You might not tell your friends how excruciating the process was. Your plumber game was a year late, costing your investors an extra $10 million, which you swear they'll get back when Super Plumber Adventure becomes the hottest thing on Steam. It turns out you overscoped in pre-production. How are you supposed to know that each level would take 4 weeks, not two? And you had to delay Super Plumber Adventure twice just to fix all the game-breaking bugs. Your team had to crunch for at least a month before each major milestone. E3, Alpha, Beta, etc. And even though you bought them all dinners to make up for it, you still can't stop thinking about the missed anniversaries, the lost birthday parties, and the evenings they didn't get to spend with their kids because they were stuck in meetings about the best color schemes for your plumber's overalls. Is there a way to make great video games without that sort of sacrifice? Is it possible to develop a game without putting in endless hours? Will there ever be a reliable formula for making games that allows for more predictable schedules? For many industry observers, the answer to those questions are no, no, and probably not. Game development is, as BioWare's Matt Goldman describes it, like being on the knife's edge of chaos, where the sheer number of moving parts makes it impossible for anyone to find predictability. Isn't that one of the reasons we love video games in the first place? That feeling of surprise when you pick up a controller and know you're about to experience something totally new. Making a game, it attracts a certain type of workaholic personality, said Obsidian's audio director Justin Bell. It just requires a certain kind of person who's willing to put in more time. Crunch sucks. It fucks your life up. You emerge from crunch and, I've got kids. I'll see my kids and I'll look at them and I'll think, wow, 6 months have passed and you're a different person now. And I wasn't there. In 2010, a Japanese company called Kairosoft released a mobile phone game called Game Dev Story. In it, you manage your own development studio, trying to release a string of popular video games without going bankrupt. You design each game by combining a genre and a style, example, detective racing. And to make progress, you'll have to make a series of managerial decisions involving your studio staff. It's a hilarious, if simplistic, take on game development. One of my favorite things about Game Dev Story is what happens during each game's production cycle, as you watch your pixelated minions perform and finish their tasks. When one of your designers, artists, or programmers is doing particularly well, they'll hit a hot streak and quite literally get set on fire. Their adorable cartoonish sprite will sit there in the office, coding away, as they're engulfed in a giant ball of flames. In Game Dev Story, this is just a sight gag, but something about it rings true. These days when I marvel at the incredible vistas of Uncharted 4 or blast my way through Destiny's addictive raids, or when I wonder how a bad video game turned out the way it did, that's the image that comes to mind. A room full of developers setting themselves on fire. Maybe that's how video games are made. This is Ray Chase. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, the triumphant, turbulent stories behind how video games are made, by Jason Schreier. This program was produced by Dion Audio. Executive producer Suzanne Mitchell. Text copyright 2017 by Jason Schreier. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.